had, we could read from, we had a Bhagavatam class this morning from chapter 12 of canto 1, so we could just continue from there. Nice section. Chapter 12 is the birth of Emperor Parikshit. It's the sages headed by Domya and Kripacharya. They're conducting the Jatakarma for Maharaj Parikshit, and they're describing what kind of a person he'll be. And describing his qualities. So, some layers of things. One is, what's the qualification of a king? Just like the instruction point of, for one to be a good king, these are qualities that a king should have, or in a broader sense, to be a leader of people. These are qualities that a leader should have. And since in the whole of society, Vaishnavas, and we're aspiring Vaishnavas, these are qualities a Vaishnava should have, because we're going to be called upon to lead people, lead, at least lead by our example. And what are some qualities that we should have to give proper example to others? This morning what we heard was how good qualities develop. Very nice report. The sages described Maharaj Parikshit as having sadguna mahatmye. Sadguna. Good qualities, or the saintly qualities. Like there's sadachar and durachar, good behavior and bad behavior. So this is sadguna and its opposite. Durguna, bad qualities. So this is, he has all good qualities. Esha Krishnam, as good as, or almost as good as Krishna. So how does one get good qualities? And one gets good qualities through association, and one can get association by the instructions that one hears, just like Dita Jayanti, where Prabhupada describes we're associating with Krishna by hearing Krishna speaking. But even more is by following the instructions that Krishna gives. To follow the instructions of the Lord is to associate with the Lord. So Maharaj Parikshit was the grandson of the Pandavas, and the Pandavas and Krishna were cousins, so they were constantly, he was constantly hearing about his ancestors or his forefathers, or the great Pandavas. And actually, because hearing about the Pandavas means hearing about Krishna. He's always hearing about Krishna. And through that association, he developed all good qualities. So, following that path, regularly, satatam, hear the Bhagavatam's message, and hear the Bhagavad Gita's message to purify us. So here's some additional qualities. The sages are saying, dritya bali sama krishne. This child will be like Bali Maharaj in patience. A little biography of Bali Maharaj in the purport. A staunch devotee of Lord Krishna like Prahlad Maharaj. That's quite a compliment. Praradha eva sadgraha. He'll be a devotee like Prahlad. A performer of many Ashvamedha yagyas, no comparison made here. Maharaj Yudhisthira, his grandfather performed Ashwamedha Yagyas under Krishna's direction, and a follower of old and experienced men. Vridhanam Paryupasakaha Paryupasate Pali. Vridhanam, old and experienced men. So, translation. This child will be like Bali Maharaj in patience, a staunch devotee of Krishna like Prahlad Maharaj, a performer of many Ashwamedha Yagyas, and a follower of the old and experienced men. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Bali Maharaj is one of the 12 authorities in the devotional service of the Lord. Bali Maharaj is a great authority in devotional service because he sacrificed everything to please the Lord and relinquished the connection of his so-called spiritual master who obstructed him on the path of risking everything for the service of the Lord. The highest perfection of religious life is to attain the stage of unqualified devotional service of the Lord without any cause and without being obstructed by any kind of worldly obligation. Paraphrasing from the second chakra. Bali Maharaj was determined to give up everything for the satisfaction of the Lord, and he did not care for any obstruction whatsoever. He is the grandson of Prahlad Maharaj, another authority in devotional service of the Lord. Bali Maharaj and the history of his dealings with Vishnu, Vamanadeva, are described in the 8th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 11, should be chapters, or chapter 11, text 24. It's 11-24. That's 11 through 24? Can't be that many chapters. Okay. Prahlad Maharaj, a perfect devotee of Lord Krishna Vishnu. His father, Hiranyakashipu, chastised him severely when he was only 5 years old for his becoming an unalloyed devotee of the Lord. He was the first son of Hiranyakashipu, and his mother's name was Kayadu. Prahlad Maharaj was an authority in devotional service of the Lord because he had his father killed by Lord Srinadeva, setting the example that even if a father should be removed from the path of devotional service, such a father happens to be an obstacle. Hare Krishna. Any questions? He had 4 sons, and the eldest son, Virochana, was the father of Bali Maharaj, mentioned above. The history of Prahlad Maharaj's activities is described in the 7th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay, so patience is the particular characteristic that's attributed to Bali Maharaj. Dhritya, patience. Nishchayat in the nectar of instruction. Patience. He describes it a little bit differently in the purport, but what does patience entail? Patience entails having full confidence in the Lord. Patience entails being free from the urge of fruitive demand. And if you haven't noticed, fruitive tendency is very strong. It's so strong that we don't even know how strong it is. I mean, it's influencing us all the time. There's instructions over and over and over in Bhagavad Gita about it, because not only in the realm of worldly activity, but in the realm of the nine processes of bhakti, the tendency to be fruitive is so strong. We're expecting some result. And to do something where there's no expectation of result, or no attachment to a particular result, is so foreign to our worldly experience. Like, some people would read the idea of working without expectation, and they would think, and they would say, I can't understand this. Who goes to work without expecting a paycheck to come from work? I mean, just work because you're supposed to work, and there's nothing on the other side. So that's not precisely what it means. What it means is employing, because with every type of work, there will be some result. Whether it's a paycheck, or supposing it's not the system that we have today where we're all hired people. Supposing it's just somebody that works. And from their work, say they're an agriculturalist and they own their land, and there's something produced from their land. So, what's the question of growing crops when there's no expectation crops will grow? I mean, that's not what it means. It's that what's the purpose of the activity? The purpose of the activity is the performance of a duty. And then the fruits of the duty are to be applied or employed in Krishna service. And that's the duty that we're, the instruction of Bhagavad Gita, or the instruction of non-fruitive work, is you do something because it's to be done. That's mode of goodness. We'll go back. Mode of ignorance is doing something begrudgingly. Mode of passion is doing something because I'm going to gain from doing it. And mode of goodness is doing something because it's to be done. Or because it's purifying. Mode of goodness purposes. And transcendental purposes is one does something out of love. For the object of love. If one is the carrier of that love, then there's some object of love. Based upon love for the object, one does something. Or doesn't do something. And to get to the position where one actually enters into a loving relationship with Krishna, a sense of doing something because Krishna says so it ought to be done, out of duty. And then when you do things, let's take it out of the commercial realm of getting a paycheck, just put it in terms of, like, you know, an agrarian based society where some persons would grow some food and some persons would make the cloth and some persons would be the blacksmith and some persons whatever the different professions are. And there wasn't money, it was just trade and barter, but it's not that let me grow lots of crops so I'll have lots of money so I can get more things. At least if one is in a devotional, like Nanda Maharaj, just to serve the cows, because that's our profession, it's our occupation. Do something because it ought to be done on the transcendental plane, because Krishna should be pleased. That's what our life is, that Krishna should be pleased. Then, when you're performing your prescribed duty, because it ought to be done, then what the previous purport was describing was it's not based upon how you feel about it. that relation of the two topics is developing qualities through like the Lord by associating with the Lord, then Prabhupada's saying that you don't need being in the presence of the Lord is achieved by the instructions of the Lord and serving the instructions of the Lord, and it's not a litmus test to say we're serving the instructions of the Lord because it feels good, or I'm feeling a certain something, therefore the Lord is present. There are varieties of emotions in the spiritual world. One can feel pain of separation while serving the Lord. And then one can say, oh, I don't like that feeling. So, the Lord must not be present, or it's not working, or it's something. So the idea here with patience is the outcome may or may not come. Like a wonderful example of this is Prabhupada's first year spent in America. He came with a service, and there was no reward. It was hardship. Very, very difficult. Extreme weather. Imagine living for being a pure devotee. Imagine being a pure devotee and being in a place where you can't even take a bath. He was living in an office space of Dr. Mishra, where he didn't even have a place to go to the bathroom or take a bath. Didn't say in the Lilamrita, but I understand there was somebody down the street that he made a friendship with, and he went down the street and took a bath. But he, you know, wow. For what? You know, and it was that a sign? Oh, it must be that Prabhupada wasn't a pure devotee, because if he was a pure devotee, Krishna surely would have provided him a place to take a bath. And a toilet. Or there would have been success in his preaching. There wasn't any apparent visible success in his preaching, but what the success was, that he was carrying out the order of his spiritual master. And it was glorious. And that later was decorated with another kind of glorious by grand success. But the success is not in the quantifiable thing. The success is in that very sincere, undeviating effort. And that's patience, transcendental patience, where there's another principle that's operating besides getting results. Now, turn it around and say, Prabhupada was results-oriented. Prabhupada wanted to know how many books, how many temples, just like that. Nice, one of those nice things hanging on the wall, and we call those things little chapters of the Prabhupada's life. It's one word. In 1 year, passage of 1 year, there were approximately three temples opened every month. From year 2000, was it? No. 1970, whatever it was. 1970 to 71, there were approximately three temples every month or year. I mean, there's 108 temples, and at a certain point he said, boil the milk. Don't make more devotees, don't open more temples. Just make more quality amongst the devotees. Because he had a mission to establish places, so he established the places. And so, when so many temples are being opened, obviously, he was happy to receive the report. One of my godbrothers is a strong advocate of, he's saying Prabhupada was practical, but saying he was also results oriented. But he was a transcendentalist, results oriented, not a fruitive, I'll do this as long as I get results. Otherwise, the first year, he would have been gone back to India. And we read in Lilamrita regularly, he would go and check the, you know, the schedule of the boats going back. And maybe I should go back, but no, I should stay. He was considering what was the right thing for him to do. So as transcendentalists, it's not that we don't care how many RTs that Radha Govinda receive a day, because we're just worshipping them, and maybe today it's this many, and tomorrow it's that many. And we're not fruitive, we're not results-oriented. We want to do certain things that are quantifiable. But the standard of our service is that Krishna is pleased, and that Krishna is pleased by the purity. And here, by the purity of Bhavi Maharaj, purity in this case, the patience was, he was ready to forego anything and everything. Inconvenience is not an inconvenience. A problem is not a problem. A sacrifice is not painful. It's, if this is what the Lord wants, great. He wants to take everything from me, great. He wants to tie me up like a criminal, great. The crime, by the way, was you promised me 3 paces of land and you only gave me 2. And with the 2, he took everything, and there was nothing left to give for the 3rd pace. So you've committed a crime, I'm tying you up. But it wasn't, and he was happy to be tied up, because it was just a reciprocation with Vamana. And Vamana, Dave then described afterwards, I did this, because this whole debate, some person said, oh, this is terrible. Some person said, oh, this is wonderful. Prahlad Maharaj's grandfather came and said, this is wonderful. This is perfectly just. And then, you know, persons on different sides stating their opinion. Then the Lord said, I did this just to show all of you what is the level of surrender of Bali Maharaj. Even he gave everything and there was nothing more to give. So sacrificed was he. If I wanted to tie him up, he's fine with it. Another nice example we discussed during our Navadvip Yatra, Mayapur Yatra, was Shivananda Sen. Shivananda Sen was taking care of hundreds of devotees. We sometimes have festivals, and it takes a lot to organize a big festival with hundreds of devotees, just for one day, with everything that's fixed. Like, there's the kitchen, there's the temple room, there's the door, there's the security, and you know, we have our whole thing set up. But still, to organize a festival for several hundred devotees, it's not a, you know, snap. He was taking care of several hundred devotees with no same place to stay every night, no same place to eat every night, and, you know, one can only imagine somebody's got an illness or someone's got a something, and then taking care of all the toll crossings and all the everything by foot, and different arrangements every time, every day. He was taking care of hundreds of devotees. And one time, because he was busy taking care of things and told the devotees, you go ahead to the next town and wait, I'll be there as soon as I can, and he was late. You know how things go, especially in India. Something should take that much time takes 10 times that much time. Just happens. What happened? It's like the energy works that way. Just try to get people onto a bus. Okay, there's the bus, there's the door, time to go. Right? So, those that were in Mayapur know it. I had to run around and get a whip and yell at people and get on the bus. Where's your bus? Right there. Get on it, okay? Now. Don't look at me like, what am I saying now for? Now. Get on your bus. Okay, thank you. And then the next person would have to do it every morning. That was a nice, jolly start for the morning. So, things took time, and Shivananda Sen was late. So Lord Nityananda became very angry in a purposeful, hard-to-understand, transcendental way. He said, that Shivananda Sen, I'm sitting here waiting and waiting, and I'm so hungry I could die. And there's nothing to eat. I curse him that his two sons should die for this. That's pretty radical. I was speaking last night about, extreme behavior, so that was pretty extreme. Your son should die because I'm hungry. And he's a transcendentalist, so was he lost control of his senses or something? But it wasn't that. So the devotees became very disturbed. Shivananda's sons have been cursed to die. And when Shivananda Sen finally caught up, his wife told him what Lord Nityananda said, and he was upset with his wife. Why are you speaking like this? Worse than that should happen. We've inconvenienced Lord Nityananda. We should be severely punished. We should die. And when he came before Lord Nityananda to apologize, I've made the arrangement, I've got a place for you to stay and your meal's waiting. And he came with that information and just came to pay obeisances in full force. Lord Nityananda kicked him right in the chest. Boom! And Shivananda Sen said, thank you! You've demonstrated now that you've accepted me as your servant. My life is made perfect. Thank you. Lord Nityananda was very pleased by his response. So, patience. Despite, he's making all these sacrifices just to please Lord Nityananda and serve Lord Chaitanya's devotees, and boom, your son should die and kick you in the chest. Happy. Of course, that's pretty extreme. But Lord Nityananda is pretty extreme. And he understood it was mercy. His sons didn't die, by the way, and he received Lord Nityananda's mercy. So, patience, real patience, is something that's transcendental. It's faith in the Lord, not in outcomes of things. If the outcome goes this way or that way, let us try our best, earnest, sincere best, to do what we can do to serve Krishna, and the outcome is fully in his hand. And if we continue to persevere, like Prabhupada continued to persevere in New York City, the outcome will come by the Lord's plan. And Prabhupada had said, even if nobody had come, if I had gone back and nobody had come, I had fulfilled the instructions of my spiritual master, and therefore I was satisfied. Right? He carried out the instruction. The instruction was go and preach. Now go and preach means you'll bring people. Anyway, so patience requires a non-fruitive mentality, and non-fruitive mentality means on both sides. Ahoitoki, there's no material causation for the action, and apratiyata, there's no material obstacle that can check one's enthusiasm. No material obstacle that can check one's enthusiasm. Because there's no material prompt that's causing the action or the enthusiasm. It's the Lord's instruction. Now, certainly it's possible if we're given a task to do and there's obstacles, we can feel some apprehension or some anxiety, some concern, and double and redouble and quadruple our effort, but at the same time patient for the result. Prabhupada says it twice in the purport. The highest perfection of religious life is to attain the stage of unqualified devotional service without any cause or without being obstructed by any kind of worldly obligation. The worldly obligation with Bali Maharaj was his spiritual master said, don't do it. Don't give these three paces of land. And he went against, he had his justification. He said, according to the Vedas, everything should be offered to Vishnu. Now you're saying this is Vishnu, and you're saying don't give to Vishnu. Well, I can't follow that because I have to follow what the Vedas say. Veda says everything goes to Vishnu. So his, at this case, Sukracharya was an instruction. And even at the risk of whatever the reaction may be, if there was one, I accept it because I must follow the injunction of the Vedas. But besides, you know, he was at heart a devotee. And there's the Lord who's asking for something. The answer is yes. Even before asking, what is it you want? The answer is yes. There's a blank check. Filling him out, whatever you say. The answer is yes. And again, Prabhupada writes, Bali Maharaj was determined to give up everything for the satisfaction of the Lord, and he did not care for any obstruction whatsoever. So, apratiyata. Nothing can check pure devotional service. So that's one of four. Patience, like Bali Maharaj. And a staunch devotee of Krishna, like Prahlad Maharaj. Krishna Parada Iva Sadgraha. A devotee like Prahlad. Devotee of Krishna like Prahlad. So Prahlad's determination was also severely tested. He was told by Hiranyakashipu, don't chant. Stop talking about Vishnu. I can't stop talking about Vishnu. I'm his devotee. Like Haridas Thakur. When the Kazi told Haridas, look, you're nice. You come from a nice Muslim family. Just, you know, follow the teachings of the Muslim faith and everything will be all right. We'll leave you alone. Why can't you do that? And Haridas said to the Kazi, What is the wrong in what I've done? If a Hindu became a Muslim, whatever would be fitting punishment for a Hindu that becomes a Muslim, you should punish me that way. And if your punishment is that I must stop chanting, then I say, if you can punish me by cutting my body into a million little pieces and still I'll continue to chant. Meaning it's coming from the soul, not from the body. Muslim, Hindu is not an issue. It's calling out the holy name. So if there's some obstacle, some intimidation type of obstacle, nothing can stop the flow of devotional service. And in what Prabhupada is pointing here, in Prahlad Maharaj's case, it was his father was the obstacle. So his father had to be removed. And so his father was removed. And it's not like, you know, we've got to get rid of our fathers telling us don't chant. But we should be prepared that if whatever the degree of obstacle that may come our way, devotional service can't be checked. There was a time when the devotees were getting arrested but for performing Harinam Sankirtan. I was arrested once. I was arrested in Chicago for performing Harinam Sankirtan before they, you know, they had to made it legal. Paddy Wagon came up and took me and three other devotees and went to the police station. And I was remembering what Prabhupada had said, because it had earlier happened that in Melbourne the devotees were put in jail for chanting. So they asked Prabhupada, should we get a lawyer and get ourselves, you know, get the devotees out of jail? He said, no. He said, they just chant in jail. Now that was at a time when we didn't have any money, and there were other times when Prabhupada said, get lawyers, but it was the right thing to say. What happened was, because they were in jail chanting, they became like martyrs. You know, the media was filled with the news, oh, the police have arrested these people for singing God's name on the street. So it was, the press was so heavy on the police, they released them. And I was released from the Chicago jail after a few hours. I guess that wasn't worth it or something. It was just like, you know, slap on the wrist, don't do that. So, Hare Krishna. If there is some obstacle to our rendering of devotional service, we then, in that difficult circumstance, we render devotional service. Like the economy is going down. So what does that mean? It's a great opportunity for preaching. That's what it means. The economy is going great. What does it mean? It's a great opportunity for preaching. Different type of preaching, but this type, that type. One morning walk in Mayapur, Prabhupada was describing, it was a current event, it was some tension that was developing between India and Pakistan, and the United States was taking the side of Pakistan and Russia was taking the side of India. And Prabhupada said, if this escalates between India and Pakistan, and it's always going, something's going on between India and Pakistan, if it escalates, it could end up being a world war. Because if India didn't, Russia takes the side of India and America takes the side of Pakistan, it's atomic war. It's a catastrophe. So then devotees were he was serious about it. He said, this is the nature of the material world. Bamboos crashing in the bamboo forest. So devotees said, Prabhupada, what should we do? Should we start gathering rations and putting them in our farms so that there's an all-out war in the world? And, you know, at least the devotees will be taken care of. And Prabhupada was disgusted. Why are you thinking like that? Krishna will take care of us, and what we should be thinking of is how to take care of other people, not take care of ourselves, and preach Krishna consciousness. That during the war it'll be great for preaching, and after the war it'll be great for preaching. That was Prabhupada's response. So if an obstacle can be seen as in a very different way by a devotee, and the devotee should expect Krishna's protection. Staunch devotee like Prahlad Maharaj, performer of many Ashvamedha yagyas, he performs many, as did his forefathers and other personalities. And there's a follower of the old and experienced in that last point. When at the very beginning of this section they make a statement that this child who has just been born, who previously while still within the womb saw the personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, face to face, his whole life will be like this, blessed by Lord Vishnu. So Yudhisthira interrupted and said, that's very nice, I want to know one thing. Is he going to be a follower of his previous ancestors? And I've heard Prabhupada speak on this many times in other places, not just speaking on this verse, but refer to this point, that a qualified king or a qualified leader or a qualified devotee must be a follower of predecessor acharyas, great teachers or great personalities that in our or the example setting ones, and follow them, not imitate, not be equal to them, follow them. And so here that's being said directly. He's a follower of the elderly and experienced men, as opposed to rebellious and by spirit too much independent minded. A great person has a great strength, and they apply that great strength following the great personalities. It's just their nature to do that. The misuse is great strength, go a different direction, carve out another path in the wilderness. Okay. Any thoughts or discussion on this? Yeah.
Here you mentioned that the patience is the Sanskrit word is dhriti, yeah. For patience.
Dhritya, not dhriti, different word. Dhritya, spelled D-H-R-T-Y-A, long A, dhritya.
I was just thinking, because like in Bhagavad Gita, the dhriti word is used for determination, so the connection between determination and patience is just like the strong faith, which is...
Yeah. There may be a etymological root of the two, dhriti and dhritya, because dhritya is by patience. Maybe it's... I don't know Sanskrit well enough to know. Is it? Do you know Sanskrit?
Little bit.
Huh?
Very little. Very little.
Enough to say that one is
yeah.
from the derived from the other?
Yeah.
Dhritya is derived from dhriti.
Yeah. Looks like.
Sounds right. Yeah.
I'm trying to understand the link between patience and determination.
Well, the link between patience and determination is we mentioned. There's our own determination, but that's the mind. And then there's the spiritual determination, and that's linked with the Supreme. It's faith in the Supreme, not faith in our mightiness. I'm going to do it, I'm going to conquer, and I am. But in the shelter of the Supreme Lord, I have full faith. Then it's unconquerable resolute purpose. And then the outcome, one can be very patient for the outcome because it's in the Lord's hand. Yeah.
Prabhupada Maharaj, you were saying how Nanda Maharaj, you said how he heard for his family, you know, heard the cow, the ox be done. And you're using that as an example of activity performing the Lord's goodness. So my question regards, I remember there was one question and answer. Like that, which you were talking about last night. In which you talked, you were in this particular set of answers. You weren't exactly encouraging working in the world as much. in one sense. I mean, just an emphasis you were placing. Obviously, I know how you could also emphasize the other. And so I was wondering, so in these days where most jobs that people get, they involve themselves in various sorts of, they're connected anyway, at least indirectly, in lots of sinful activities.
Yes, it is.
So,
the case.
Would you say that motive goodness, that such activities could still be described as motive goodness if one's not a transcendentalist, if one's doing it to with detachment and because at least one should feed one's family or something like that?
It's not the activity is motive goodness, but the consciousness can be motive goodness. Like, you know, an example the Prabhupada gives in Bhagavad Gita is working in a factory. Mm-hmm. Working in a factory by nature is not motive goodness, but one's consciousness can be quite detached.
Mm-hmm. Even not as a transcendentalist,
even
but
as
motive goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, because I have to feed my family, that's not a non-fruitive motivation. That's a fruitive motivation.
Okay.
But because it's dutiful. A good person does their work. A good person accepts a job and does an honest labor to do their job. And they do it conscientiously and so on. So, in that sense, there's no avoidance for a non-devotee to become free from passion, in the sense of, you know, I am maintained, through my labor I maintain, because there's the fruit, and the fruit has to go somewhere. So I and mine is, it's not goodness. But so, the mode of goodness connects primarily with religion. You know, there's a religious duty. Like, let's say, I take a marriage vow, so I'm just duty bound, and so religiously I continue in this situation. Or I take a job, because that's what we're talking about. So I'll fulfill this. And, you know, I may take another job after some time. But while I'm taking this job, I'll fulfill it. Just because that's what a good, honest person does.
Okay, a follow-up question.
Yeah.
This is a more specific question, less abstract than that one. Would a devotee, a transcendentalist, would he have a preference? And for that matter, a strong preference to between choosing two lines of work, say choosing that work which can create much good in the world, but not transcendental knowledge. For example, helping animal rights compared to regular
animal testing. Yeah, compared to that, sure.
Why philosophically? In my heart, I think yes, of course, but
because it's on the bodily, because we're speaking on the bodily platform, we're not speaking on the transcendental platform.
But this is a transcendentalist choice of what to do.
Yeah, it's more in the mode of goodness than killing is. Killing the rats instead of giving protection to anyone. It's like your profession. You've been through this. There's things that where you can add value to society by just starting a living. And it has both the work atmosphere and just your own internal consciousness can be very much different, depending upon, something that there's some cause. I just had this discussion in Chicago with someone that's in the law practice. And they're in, I forget what type of law. But they were wanting to get into not-for-profit law or some other kind of law. And so I directed them towards a religious not-for-profit. So, that's exactly. And it was the back of the fund. Oh, I'd love to work for those people. tax fund in Washington, because it's a cause that in principle you're protecting the rights of innocent people. Oh, the patent law that they're doing now.
Oh.
So, you know, it's a job, as opposed to it's something they can put their heart into. And both have their complications and so on and so on. And not necessarily, anyway. There are, I'll give a Gopal Bhatt example. His assessment is there, I forget the language that he uses, but there's some jobs, like, before he bought Closet Factory, he calls it Neutral. Closet Factory is the company that he works, that he owns. And when he left being the president of the LA Temple, he was a householder with two children and no education and no means of, you know, maintaining himself. But he felt it was the duty of the householder to not just take money from the temple, but to, you know, he went that direction. So because he's who he is, he started buying businesses that were failing, turning them around, and then selling the businesses. He got really good at it. Then he found what he liked, because in his language, was neutral, making closets. Not like mood of goodness, but it's not, you know, killing animals or, you know, some other kind of compromising thing. So that's a criterion for a devotee. It's along the lines of your question.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like the only criterion, because if it was the only criterion, then a lot of devotees wouldn't have jobs, because jobs are, you know, the industry that it's connected to is contaminated. One way or the other, more or less. Mm-hmm. Like one devotee was describing, he has this, you know, brilliant student. He was, he has his PhD, he was doing research for a company that makes different ways of determining radar. He said, I know how to do the thing, but I know the application. So I'm not responsible for the application, but I know how they're going to apply it. It's war. It's war, you know, war technology. And, you know, there's billions of dollars going into nanotechnology. You know, what's the purpose of it? Later on, they'll use it for, you know, medical and this and that. But, you know, the upfront money is war toys for the big guys. Oh yeah, everyone's cell phone. Where'd that come from? War technology. So then there's civilian applications. So a devotee needs to think about what is something that I'm. If there's an opportunity and a range of choices between something that's giving value and something that's not, it's better to choose something that's giving value, or at least that's neutral.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's been very inspiring and pleasing to hear about Maharaj Parikshit's pronouncement when he was a child. Just thinking how his father was not there, Abhimanyu was not there, but his ancestors must have been so pleased just hearing those. Just thinking, what are in our stage of Krishna consciousness, where we are trying to be aspiring for parenthood, what are the appropriate desires that one can carry for
prospective parents, or for the prospective child that you might have?
for the child that we might have? What are the desires that we should cultivate?
Well, Prabhupada's example, referring to his father, is one of the nicest I can think of. That is, when he would bring sadhus to the home, he would ask the sadhu, please bless this child that he becomes a nice devotee of Srimati Radharani. That's up there.
There is a tendency to desire something very exalted, although we are way down here.
Well, that's another thing. That's what qualification do I, as a prospective parent, place before Krishna, in my service? But that wasn't your question. So if I'm going to wish that for my prospective child, son or daughter, then let me qualify myself. Because if I get someone who is a son or daughter that's going to be a very dear devotee to Srimati Radharani, then I better be capable of taking care of them.
Mm-hmm.
Guiding them, leading them, setting examples.
Thinking on the answer that you gave me in the morning, and just what you spoke this evening about feeling the presence and happiness. So I was taking this example of Shivananda saying that God, Nityananda chastised him. He felt very happy.
He was very happy.
But if we take this situation of Lord Chaitanya chastising Chota Haridas, then there was so much of heavy, sad feeling of being not in presence of the Lord. So is it at the center of the relationship and it is love, then whatever feeling comes out of this, whatever it is.
Because in fact, Lord Chaitanya made an arrangement for him to have association after he left his body. His service, one of his favorite services where Lord Chaitanya was singing for the pleasure of Lord Chaitanya, he continued that even after he gave up his Chota Haridas body by Lord Chaitanya's arrangement. So, but Lord Chaitanya, through him, because he was so dear to him, through him, he wanted to teach the world. Because the opposite was being done, in the name of sannyas, it was then a license to, you know, do inappropriate things. It was, you know, the opposite. So a follower of Lord Chaitanya will not do that. In order to get, you know, allure, attraction, and appreciation, and something from other people, take sannyas to be a debauched person, not a follower of Lord Chaitanya. Very strict. But you know, deliberately, with his own devotee. So, your question was the feelings of Chota Haridas, that was appropriate. But, you know, it's on a transcendental platform. Our feelings, oh, somebody said something hard. I got chastised. It's, you know, from a different place than Chota Haridas.
Guru Maharaj, when we are trying to move from
this position of always looking for outcomes in whatever I do in devotional service to focusing on family relationships. I'm seeing that at times I'm getting impatient with myself when I go blank. Although, at least I understand in principle that I shouldn't refer to feelings, but when I go blank without any feelings towards this relationship, the difficulty I'm having is because of the constant reminders, when we're trying to focus on that, on those relationships, it's becoming more personal, and even some small slip or some small fallback is making me feel impatient.
I got the picture. Fortunately, I know the background, so I got the picture. Here's one thought. The tendencies don't change quickly. Tendencies don't form quickly. Tendencies take a long time to form. And to change tendencies takes time. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his Tattva Viveka, I believe it is, he describes that you can plan on taking 5 years to change a bad habit. He writes that specifically. And something like what you're speaking about, it's not specific, it's pervasive, such a tendency. So, pervasive meaning it applies, we have so many relationships, it's not just a relationship with one person, it's a tendency. So, fall at Bhaktivinoda Thakur's feet and pray for the quality of patience. You know, 5 years worth. And continue. Another point is focus more on the positive and less on the negative. What you should do rather than what you shouldn't do. Focus on Vajana Kriya, which brings about Anartha Nivritti, not focus on Anartha Nivritti. You follow? Well, focus on what you should do. And strength will come from doing what you should do, and that strength can be applied in eradicating the fault or the bad habit or the unwanted tendency. Yeah.
You were mentioning about results, even in devotional service. That
you're a results oriented person?
But how to compare, how to get over the tendency of comparing devotees based on result-oriented actions, right?
I don't know what you mean.
Like comparing devotees in the sense that, they accomplished this versus they...
Well, let's look at Prabhupada. You know, before and after. And are we going to say he wasn't a pure devotee and then he became a pure devotee? So, should we apply that standard to others? What's the criterion that we should use? That the criterion that we should use is their attachment to Krishna. And what are the, you know, the measures of their attachment to Krishna? Their determination is unwavering. Their qualities are always very pleasing. Consistently. I mean, I know some devotees that, you know, we can have some fun and glorify some devotees. Like Dhananjaya Pandit. There's a devotee that everybody likes. And he's not a big results devotee. But he's a devotee that everybody likes. So, is he dear to Krishna? Does he have love, like a strong desire to please Krishna in his heart? You bet. What's his destination after this lifetime? So he's not offended at devotee. Doesn't have a sense of bone in his body. And so on. So, as a, you know, our fruitive tendencies are what they are. That we already have our certain quantity of fruitive tendencies. So it's not we're supposed to make them zero. We're supposed to purify them. You know, make our efforts zero. The effort should be what matches the circumstance before us. And if there's some effort, what we should be monitoring in our own case and, you know, in others, to whatever degree we can, is the motivation to please Krishna. And if the motivation is to please Krishna, then someone may make, you know, Herculean effort. But is the motivation to please Krishna? And to the degree that there's attachment to Krishna, that Krishna should be pleased. That's our consideration of the person's Krishna consciousness or their advancement, not some quantitative thing. It can be a matter of going more deep into your own Krishna consciousness and looking at work for Krishna, like, you know, pondering more deeply what does that mean and how to do it. Just being, you know, centered, then operating from that center, as opposed to like just manipulating the material energy and using your mind, and, you know, then it's just material, then it's just a job. But to work from the place of, you know, so let's just say, because I don't know what you do, but it could, you know, same thing could apply for so many people that I don't know what they do. The work itself may not be something that you can place on a nice platter and offer to Krishna. That this is for you. You know, designing a software program, some people may be doing, it has nothing to do with, you know, this is for you. But it can be, I want to do this very nicely for you, and the for you part is because the other people in the office that I can perhaps influence in Krishna consciousness will not have any respect for Krishna consciousness if I'm not doing very well in my work. Or for a child, a youth going to school, I must excel in my academics because other people know that I'm a devotee and they're going to be judging how much they value a lot, my being a devotee. It'll devalue it if I'm doing lousy in my academics, or increase the value if I'm doing well in my academics. So I must do well in my academics for Krishna, because it's going to have some impact on how much regard they have for Krishna and Krishna consciousness. When I do speak, something happens, some interaction comes, and some Krishna conscious words come out. It'll be devalued if I'm an underperformer. So for Krishna, I must perform. Not because I like the stuff. And if I not only perform well, but if I'm literally fixed in Krishna's consciousness in the various ways that may demand, given your psychophysical makeup and the situation at work, or at school, or in the office, or whatever different people's things may be. How much centered I am in Krishna will directly correlate to the purity when I do speak something and how it's going to move somebody. Or just, even I don't speak something, just being in the office and being Krishna conscious. Like, you know, take Bhaktivinoda Thakur's example. Or Prabhupada's example, as a pharmacist. What does pharmacy have to do with offering it to Krishna? Or what it, with being a high court judge? That's maybe more because it's, you know, justice and injustice, or truth and, you know, wrongdoing, and, you know, being on the side of truth. But many people, you know, I would guess many people would not relate that to, you know, being a devotee. But his being a devotee was in that position was able to influence people. Even in the position, let us speak of outside the position. So that's a way that you can serve Krishna in the workplace. It's something I relate to it in this way. In many, many circumstances where I move about, I'm not directly speaking, you know, travel. I understand that I'm a little emissary of Krishna wherever I go. People are judging the Hare Krishna movement based upon what I do, what I don't do, if I'm courteous, you know, so on. And just, even if I say nothing, just sit there, just being to the degree that I'm Krishna conscious, it's helping. Nonverbal spiritual influence is just helping the atmosphere, as opposed to the other way around. A nonverbal somebody that's in that consciousness. So, it's a challenge, for sure, being a householder, being embodied is a challenge. Being embodied in a household ashram is a challenge. Being in the workplace is a challenge to your Krishna consciousness, but that's, you know, the challenge of choice. You know, one way or another way, it's a challenge. So take that challenge and turn it into how to be, just meditate on it. You know, there's not like a secret formula how to. It's be determined to be Krishna conscious in that situation, and Krishna will give you the indicators. It doesn't mean like the end result is you have a very nice RT train, you offer it to Krishna, here's this, I just worked on this case, and here it is, Krishna, it's for you. That's not what it means. You know, in some service, some occupations, it may mean that. The florist who saved the nicest flowers when Krishna came, gave them the nicest flowers. Because that was Master's occupation. But you know, all the other people that came to get flowers, it's not like, you know, you take the crummy ones so I can give the nice ones to Krishna. Yeah, it's the consciousness with which you do your work. Okay, we're missing Arti. Let's go. Maybe over. If you'd rather go over there, maybe kiss. And then take part in smoke the chanting or whatever else is happening. Are the kids going to be doing some stuff? Reciting verses?
The website says that they are.
Okay, let's go.
So join the program. Yeah.
Let's go join the program. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada.
Bless you, Maharaj.